But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools if they ask her to focus on. Take a look at the low man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Mars?
WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. Welcome to See It, Stream It, Skip It, your weekly guide to the movies with Derek Gary and Shay Spillane. I'm Derek Gary.
I'm Shay Spillane.
You are Shay Spillane. You are still Shay Spillane after all these years. Everything that we've been through together, you are still the one and only Shay Spillane. Coming up later, we're going to be breaking down. I'm going to offer some tips on how to pick in your Oscar pool. Because a lot of people sit there and they're like, I like this movie. That's not how it works. You're never going to win your Oscar pool.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, if you're voting for what you like, you're going to be wildly disappointed.
Yeah, so we'll get into that a little bit.
Which is wildly inaccurate.
But we will start, as we do every week, with the question, Shay, what did you see this past week?
This past week, I'm trying to think. I didn't see anything this past week. I'm seeing something tomorrow.
Okay, we need this past week. This, you know, it's.
I was busy this week. Normally, I see like at least 3 movies a week.
Oh dear, what am I gonna? We need you seeing. Well, I got to cheat because it. What I saw was on Netflix. I saw 2, in the past week. Both of them Oscar nominated. I want someone to explain to me why Netflix can't simply have, you know, you go into the interface and they've got all of these categories with lists of movies underneath them, and you're swiping right for 45 minutes and then you just give up and turn on the TV because you can't find anything you want to watch. Why they can't just have an Oscar-nominated category with all of the Oscar-nominated films that they have on Netflix? Why don't you do that? Why don't you make it possible for me to just go in there, hit up my home screen, and it's like, oh, here are your Oscar-nominated films. No, I've got to get Top Picks and Netflix Originals, and we think you might like. You know what I would like, Netflix? You know what I would like? Oscar-nominated films all in one place on the home screen.
Yeah, I don't really get why they wouldn't just have that be like a default.
Not hard to do.
Like, it's, I mean, they have categories. They have some of the most ridiculous categories that you've ever seen on Netflix.
Yeah.
Like, sassy, irreverent workplace comedy. Yeah. Like, that's a thing.
Yeah.
Well, I guess technically I did watch a documentary, but it doesn't count as a movie because it was 3 parts.
Well, that's still a movie. I mean,
The Aaron Hernandez documentary.
Oh, yeah. No.
I was going to say, that's what I was sitting there being like, I always manage to watch something new. That was fascinating.
I am so close to that story because I've got a client that's involved in that story, and my client is in that documentary. So the whole Aaron Hernandez, the whole Aaron Hernandez case came back to ruin another workday for me, which is really how I look at it at this point. It's good. I didn't necessarily learn anything new out of it.
I did. Well, you have to consider too that like, the most I really totally knew about it was because some of the incidences surrounding things happened at Cure and at Rumor, which are both locations of Nick's Comedy Stop.
Right.
And I remember after whatever happened at Rumor, I got questioned one night by by a Boston Globe reporter. And I was just like, dude, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I leave at 10.
I think that was a double homicide.
I was going to say that was that. But there were a lot of things in terms of like about his past and about the specifics, and obviously not excusing anything, like not excusing anything that happened or anything he did, but it definitely, I mean, if anything, it just explained it a little bit more.
I don't know that I like the operating theory of the movie, which is that, and they don't flat out say this, but they feed it to you between the lines, which is the idea that Aaron Hernandez was a closeted homosexual who was bubbling with rage at the fact that he couldn't live his authentic life, and that that pushed him over the
edge. I was going to say, that was a big... Well, and I did hear that... I did hear that somebody said that they took their interview very much out of context.
Yeah.
And I imagine that they did that with everybody.
Yeah.
And with all of the...
Because it said, and the reason I have a problem with it is, it strikes me as coming from that demonize the gay man, you know, gays are aberrant school of thought. And in this day and age, for somebody to be sort of putting that out there, you know, if you want to talk about the institutions and the reality that may have kept Aaron Hernandez closeted, particularly with regard to his father, who's a real piece of work, then I think you can explore that. But they more or less present it as, you know, oh, he's an angry closeted gay, and he just exploded. Well, no, because there's a lot of angry closeted gays.
Who don't commit multiple murders. And well, and also on top of that, it's like you can't say, oh, it was just this.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't just that. It wasn't just anything. You know, it was very much. It was a percolating mixture of so many different factors, and I mean, again, that, well, that's just like you said. Like, I mean, I was talking to my mother the other night about, I'm obviously not going to say her name on the radio, but about a person that we know who is like an incredibly unpleasant person to be around. Like, she is just one of those people who you get like, there's like a stink, a proverbial stink in the air when she walks in the room. Like, suddenly the energy is just bad. And my mom was saying, oh, well, you know, she has, to be fair, she has been through a lot. And I was like, yeah, but the thing is, I know so many people who have been through just as much, if not more, who are incredibly pleasant people to be around, and who don't, because, I mean, it's just a cop out. It's like you said, it's like there are plenty of people repressing their homosexuality who did not go and kill. Like, yeah. One of the people on the documentary was a former Patriots player who talked about how he said football was my beard.
Yeah.
Like,
and he's like, I was like, gay. I didn't go out and kill people.
Yeah. You know? Like, he said, like, football was my beard. And yeah. Like, I hit it. And yeah, he didn't go out and kill a bunch of people.
Yeah. That bugs me a little bit. Other than that. Yeah. And by the way, Netflix counts. You know, if we're talking about movies, that's a movie. So, props to you. I think I talked about American Factory last week. And if I didn't, it is one of the Academy Award nominated feature documentaries. I highly recommend that you watch this. And you'll know more of why I highly recommend that you watch this in 2 weeks when we do our Oscar picks. But I highly recommend that you watch this, not just because it's nominated, but because it really is a great documentary. The filmmakers had extraordinary access to everybody involved in this. And you get a lot of people speaking candidly, which you never get. You know, you watch the news, you watch interview programs, everybody's like, nobody answers a question. Nobody tells you how they really feel. This lays it all on the line. So I recommend that. I think I recommended it last week. I watched one of the shorts. I think there's only one of the shorts that's on Netflix right now. It's called Life Overtakes Me. And not impressed. Basically, it's a film about these Ukrainian refugees in Sweden. And these kids who have seen traumatic things, they all tend to be between the ages of, I believe, 8 and 14, 15, slip into this comatose state. They just sleep all day long. They don't respond to anybody. They don't do anything. All they do is sleep. And this condition has gone on for more than a year in some cases. And it's tied into the status of immigrants in Sweden and, you know, whether or not these families are going to have to go back home where horrible things have happened to them. They mentioned that it seems to be limited to this one community of Ukrainian immigrants. The Ukrainian immigrants, they mentioned this is happening in other parts of the world. It never really gets past the point of being, let's stare at this as a documentary. And there's no attempt to really reconcile any sort of science or psychology behind it. It's, this is a thing that's happening. Let's look at these kids. Let's stare at them for 15 minutes.
Yeah, like it doesn't actually say anything about any of it.
So tough for me to recommend. It is not tracking well in the Oscar, amongst the Oscar pundits. So if you are inclined to skip it, feel free, because I can understand why it was nominated, because within the short documentaries, you tend to get at least, you know, two or three films, and in the features as well, you tend to get at least two or three films that are very much about what's happening right now, that are explorations of interesting or essential political topics. Certainly immigration is one of the biggest political topics in the world right now. And this is an entryway into that. But I'm going to say you can pass. If you got the time, stream it. But it really is a skip it as a film.
Yeah.
The other one that I watched and very much enjoyed is The Two Popes, which has been nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. It's based on a play. And Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor for Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce, who play Pope Benedict and Pope Francis.
Ah.
And I don't know how much of this is true. I don't know how much of this is real. But it's, the basic setup is Francis wants to retire because he's kind of fed up with what's happening in the Catholic Church. So he goes to Rome to have Pope Benedict sign his resignation letter. And Benedict seems to have ulterior motives for wanting Francis there and is refusing to sign the letter. And we see the relationship grow between the two of them. And they talk about what it means to be Pope. And they talk about faith and they talk about the church. But they also talk about, you know, there's a scene where they're drinking nice whiskey. And one of them is a big football fan, and one of them doesn't get it at all. It really leans into that fascination that we have with what goes on behind the curtain. The two of them are really the only ones.
That's what I was going to say, is that you never really get to see, like, what actually goes, like, the only images we really have of the Pope is him sitting on the Pope chair.
Yeah.
And on the balcony of the Vatican.
Which is fairly unique for any public figure these days.
Yeah, I mean, we have, think about, one of my favorite like photo blogs is where the official White House photographer for when Barry Obama's was in office, he picked like his favorite 100 pictures of Barack Obama. Arguably, like, the president of the United States, he, back in the day, you'd only see him like a very official capacity. Yep. And there were pictures of him like laying on the ground and like, you know, like doing like swimming, like doing usually most public figures these days, we're seeing every part of their life short of them in the bathroom.
It has come a long way from the days when the press was forbidden from showing Franklin Delano Roosevelt using his braces or sitting in a wheelchair or any of that. Because that was very, very carefully controlled in the press to make it look like he was a fully able-bodied individual, when in fact polio had robbed him of the ability to walk unassisted.
Mm.
Not that he didn't try, not that he wasn't working at it, but he did not want the American people to see that, because he, especially during wartime, he thought it would lead both the American people and our enemies to believe that he was frail. And FDR was anything but frail. His legs may not have worked well, but that was a pretty rough and rugged guy. So it leans into this fascination that we've got. You know, what goes on, you know, in the papal quarters when the lights are out and the Swiss Guard's gone home. And it's a very charming film.
I feel like it'd be like a cute buddy comedy.
Price and Hopkins are really the only ones that speak in the entire film. And it goes a bit into the history of Pope Francis and things that were happening in Argentina in the 1970s and things, actions that he took during the revolution. And there are some really, really nice moments in the film. I think it's a film that you should see. It's a film that's worth streaming. It's there. If you've cleaned out your queue and you got nothing else going on, it's worth seeing. It's worth seeing solely for the acting, because the performances here, you know, it's Jonathan Pryce and Anthony Hopkins. It's amazing. They're great. These are two great actors doing great acting opposite each other. But you really come to like them as this movie goes on, and you come to get a slightly greater understanding of the past life of a pope. Because we look at popes and we're like, oh, he's a man of the cloth and he's perfection and all the rest of this. This movie really exists to sort of dispel that myth a little bit, you know, because we see some of the difficult choices that Francis had to make. And there's an undercurrent throughout the film where people are calling Pope Benedict a Nazi because he's German. So it makes for an entertaining couple of hours. You know, it's a nice way to spend a Saturday night, and I recommend streaming it. If it was in the theater, I'd probably tell you to go see it in the theater. So, big win.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, big win for the Pope. So, next week, we're not going to be here.
We are not.
Have I told you that?
I was going to say, you announced in your little clandestine just slid off the air.
Some people may not have been around for that.
Oh, that's true.
We're off next week because I got a thing I got to do. And that's the last time that's going to happen for a while. Well, until the baby's born. We'll probably be off. You know, if my wife is thoughtful, she'll have the baby on a Thursday and then I can be back for the show the following week. Knowing her, she'll be like, oh, it's Wednesday, I'm going into labor. I'm going to be like, I have a show. She's like, I have a baby. And I'm like, priorities. It's going to be a tough call. But
I would say, all of a sudden, this baby is so important. Yeah, God, Molly.
I have to live with the wife. So I think in that, I think she wins in that one. You know?
I was going to say, I will defer to Molly when it comes to scheduling.
Yeah. So, the next show that we do is going to be our annual Oscar prediction show. And Molly will hopefully be joining us. And I might be bringing in a couple of guests for this one, too. So, we're gonna amp up the competition a little bit.
It's going to get interesting.
I won't have Sarah Barcia this year because she's going to be traveling that week. But I may have some interesting surprise guests lined up for this. So, by this point, you should at least, if you're going to be in an Oscar pool, Shay Spillane, you bet on the Oscars, right?
No, we just talked about how I don't really gamble.
But I mean, it's the Oscars. You know, throw 10.
I mean, I would, if it was like an Oscar pool, if it was just like a, you know, almost like fantasy football, but with the Oscars, I guess I'd toss my hat in that ring.
All right, there we go. Go find an Oscar pool. Vote, you know, bet on this thing. Get into it. Sometimes some people go to a party and there's a prize if you get the most number right. Some people take part in pools. Some people are very serious about their pools. My winning streak was broken by my wife last year because I failed to anticipate that Green Book would be named Best Picture. I don't think that. Good movie. Great performance by Mahershala Ali. Not a film that I would have picked as Best Picture or think anyone should. But how does that happen? Because like Roma was the better movie, right? There were a lot of better movies last year. Anyway, how does this happen? Well, if you want to be successful at predicting the Oscars, you got to know and understand, this is like any other aspect of life, making predictions is a sucker's game.
That is true.
Nobody knows the future. Shay might know the future, and she's not telling me. Nobody knows the future.
I mean, I'm probably better at predicting the future than most people, but...
The best you can do, even if you run a hardcore analytic approach like I do, you're still not going to get everything right.
Yeah.
You know, nobody gets everything right every year. Some people go on streaks. They'll be like, "Ah, I got 23 out of 24 for like 4 years running. Good for you." I will stand by the fact that I have won the Oscar pool 5 of the last 6 years running. Okay? So, you know, Molly has stepped up her game because she got tired of losing to me. And normally, you know, you think of Molly, she's like this nice, you know, friendly, sweet person. You introduce the whiff of competition to her, and she turns into a monster. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding.
I was going to say, I'm trying to think if, have I ever seen her in a competitive...
No. No, you'd remember if you had.
I can picture, though, like her just throwing down.
Boy, does that girl gloat.
I was going to say, like picturing, just seeing her in like the way that she can passionately talk about something, yeah. I can see her getting passionate about like... I'm picturing Monica and Friends. You get that reference.
Yeah,
right?
I get that. That's it.
Molly, if you're listening, I'd be scared to compete against you in something.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I'm like, because the first award comes out and she's jumping up and down. She's like, "Yeah, I beat you." And I'm like, "What? Who are you? And what have you done with my wife?" So to help you gear up for this, I'm going to share some tips that inform my thinking about the Oscars and are generally helpful in figuring out what may or may not win. And again, it doesn't matter what your favorite films are, right?
Yeah. It's the opposite of matters what your favorite films are.
And a lot of people sit there and be like, "Well, Hollywood just votes for everything that's political." And it's like, no, that's not 100% true either. The first thing you need to know is how films get nominated. There are 17 branches in the Motion Picture Academy that represent the 17 different groups that make movies. Or the 16, there's an at-large branch for people who aren't connected to anything. So everybody nominates according to their branch, and everyone gets to pick the Best Picture nominees. So the Sound Awards are nominated by the Sound branch. The Costume Design Awards are nominated by the Costume Design branch. Director is nominated by the directors. The actors nominate all of the acting awards. They have more awards than anybody else. The exceptions to this are the short films and the international films, which are chosen by a committee. People submit, and it goes through a process, and it's like, yes, we like this.
The Academy.
When it gets to the voting, the actual Oscar voting, everybody votes on everything. It used to be years ago, and I've been getting this wrong, and I got to correct this. Years ago, it used to be that the technical branches voted on the technical awards, and then everybody voted on what are known as the top line awards, the big ones. Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, all that. Everybody votes for everything. So if a cinematographer is universally loathed by actors, probably not going to win.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true.
If they've made every great actress look ugly, they're not going to win. Partly because the acting branch is the biggest voting block in the Oscars. There are more than 1,200 of them. The next biggest one is, surprisingly, short films. The short films branch has 565 members. That's more than producers, 524, directors, 512, executive, 499, then, interestingly, sound, 487. So what will happen, what tends to get a film over the top is the actors, the producers, and the directors all agree on something. And then you've got, you know, half of the Academy basically saying, "Hey, we like this movie." And if the sound designers disagree, well, too bad for them, because there aren't enough of them to overcome all of that. Visual effects and sound Because they know what they're doing and they know what they're looking for, if they all move in one direction, they can potentially influence the outcome of those. And part of the reason for that is, even though every Academy member is asked to vote in every category, a lot of them don't. A lot of them sit there and they're like, I don't know sound mixing, I don't know sound editing, I'm not going to vote. Or they sit there and they're like, I didn't see those special effects films, I'm not going to vote. So you give a little bit more weight to the technical side of things and what the technical people might like in those categories, but not a ton. The other thing that you want to look at is the awards that come up before the Oscars. But you have to be careful about which award shows you look at. The Golden Globes are meaningless because that's 40 people in the press sitting around saying, well, we like this. They're not voting members of the Academy. Nobody cares. The Writers Guild rarely, if ever, picks best adapted or best original screenplay winners. Happens occasionally, but it doesn't happen often enough that you can use that as a predictor. The Sound Guild, there's a group called the Cinema Audio Society, which is basically the guild for your sound recorders, your sound mixers, your technicians, your mic operators, all those people. They pick an award for best sound mixing in a feature film that is not the same as the best sound mixing award in the Oscars. There's slightly different criteria for it. It rewards a slightly more encompassing group of people. It can be a predictor, but again, you're talking one of the smaller groups in the Academy. So you can kind of let that one go. The ones that matter are the SAG Awards, which just happened this past weekend.
Yeah.
That represents the Actors Guild, and they are the biggest voting block. So what they like for Best Picture, what they like for Best Actor, Best Actress, tends to carry a lot of weight. The Directors Guild and the Producers Guild, if you see films lining up, if you see the same awards going to the same people across these three very prominent award shows, those are films that you want to give a lot of weight to. Those are films that you want to very heavily consider.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, that's, I mean, it's like anything else. Like, it's like, say there's like a type of food, like say there's a restaurant and three people you know who are all very different palates, very different styles of how they eat, all say this restaurant's awesome.
I got a steak and potatoes guy, a vegan, and a Mediterranean diet guy, and they're all telling me, go check out the Fox and Bell or whatever the heck that place in Southie is.
Yeah, chances are, yeah, it's actually awesome. Like, as opposed to if, like, your steak and potatoes guy says, oh, this place is great, but it just has great steak and potatoes.
Right.
It's not covering everyone who actually needs a bite to eat.
Wait, the vegan and the steak and potatoes guy like that? I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's your SAG, PGA, and DGA. When they all line up, pay attention to that. The BAFTAs are a bit of a wild card because the BAFTAs are the British Academy Awards, but they tend to lean very heavily toward nominees who are from the Commonwealth. So if you got a choice between Matthew McConaughey and Prince Harry, first of all, you've lost. And those shouldn't have been your final choices. they're going to choose Prince. Can we call him Prince Harry anymore?
I forget. I saw a meme the other day that it says, call him the artist formerly known as Prince Harry.
Yeah, I like that. but they're gonna pick Prince Harry. Whereas the Academy is going to be like, oh, no, Matthew McConaughey. So there's a little bit of, you know, national, provincial bias that sets in on this. If you have, and this is where this gets to be a problem. If you have English actors and actresses nominated for top awards, and they're getting the BAFTA, and maybe they've got one or two of the others, they got the Producers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild, but not the Directors Guild, now you got a mess on your hands because who knows which one it's going to be. Fortunately, a lot of these have been moving in lockstep for several years now, and you can just look at who's winning those awards and say, all right, this analysis history tells me that this should be where it goes.
Yeah. I was going to say, it can be very just form. It's formulaic.
Yeah.
It's like doing a math problem or doing a chemistry problem.
So understand that the actors hold all the sway. The actors, directors, and producers agree on something, it's probably going to win. And all of those awards will be handed out before. In fact, SAG was this past weekend. They've all been handed out. And that has a very, very heavy weight on the predictions that people are making. If something is a shocker at the Oscars, it's because somebody won that hadn't won any of those precursor awards. Something just came out of nowhere and was like, oh my gosh, you know, we gave it to Scarlett Johansson for Best Supporting Actress. Like, no one saw that coming because she hadn't won anything yet. So those are sort of the high level things that you need to know. Mm. If a movie is made by Netflix, knock down your expectations for it by about 15%. Because there are a number of people in the Academy, a large number of people in the Academy, who will not vote for Netflix movies. They hate Netflix. They think Netflix is destroying cinema. There are producers who feel this way. There are directors who feel this way. The actors don't care. The executives do. The at-larges do. Basically, the older and more reliant you are on the old cinema system, the less likely you are to appreciate Netflix. And Netflix can break through, but they're not going to win Best Picture.
Oh, no. And, I mean, at least not for 30 years. Now, like, not until... It's still too uncomfortable.
I think it's sooner than that.
You think soon? Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I'd say not in the next 5 years, I would say.
But it's...
Or if it is in the next 5 years, it's going to... It has to be something so groundbreaking and so, like... I mean, at this point... We've kind of left the realm of nothing like this has ever been done before.
Right.
There's always some precedent, but something so like just new or done, something that's been done before, but done in a different way. Like it has to be something that it's slapping you in the face with. This is the only thing that can be Best Picture.
Roma. Yeah. I would put Roma on that list, and we saw what happened last year. Green Book won Best Picture. Roma rightfully took best international. It's now known as Best International. It was Best Foreign Language last year. Roma rightfully took that, and I think they gave Cuarón Best Director last year. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, "All right, here we go, Roma." And it's like, "Nope," because they are not going to give that award to Netflix. Not yet.
They're not ready.
You've seen The Irishman.
I have not.
How have you not seen The Irishman?
Because I don't want to watch it in parts, and I haven't had 3 consecutive hours to sit and watch it, and I also don't want to fall asleep during it.
Well, it's gonna be hard.
Well, honestly, actually, I told you I have every night this week. I'm busy, but Saturday is my like I can do whatever. So I might have to clean my bathroom. That's gonna take me at least 3 hours. Yeah. I could have that be my scrub. Watch The Irishman.
Yeah. I recommend seeing it. I don't think it's going to win anything. I'm going to say this straight up right now. I don't see The Irishman taking a single award in the Oscars. You've seen Joker.
I have seen Joker.
I don't think that's going to take an award. There's one.
I think, what do you think?
Or no, there's two, actually.
What do you think that
there's
is?
There's two. Joaquin Phoenix.
That's what I was going to say.
Won
it's,
everything.
It's definitely not going to win anything about the actual movie, but Joaquin Phoenix, I mean, that is, his acting in that is just so incredible.
I am leaning toward Best Score going to Joker.
I could see that, and that is, Best Score is always one of those kind of wild card ones where it's like, it's important, but it's not important enough that they have to throw it at one of the ones that they want to fawn over. It's like, you know, it's like, okay, we can, well, it's just like how, like, perfect example is like Best Original Screenplay when Juno won.
Yeah.
It's like Juno was not a movie that the Academy Awards wanted to toss a bunch of stuff at, but it was like, okay, we're not saying Best Director, we're not saying Best Picture, but here's a bone, Juno. Like, here you go. What's her name? the woman who wrote that.
Oh,
I can't. She's got a weird name.
It's not the only.
I keep thinking Dakota Fanning, but it's not Dakota Fanning. Something like that.
Is I've got the internet right in front of me.
Diablo Cody.
Diablo Cody.
I was, yeah. See Dakota Fanning. You see where I got that?
Yeah, it's in some cases for some of these awards, it can really be a question of like what jumps out at you, especially if you've got a lot of sameness. And this is what's happening with Best Score with Joker, is because everything else has been nominated is very traditional. Like, yes, Alexander Desplat is back again. John Williams is back again. And we've heard all of this before. I'm not quite ready to rule out giving John Williams the Lifetime Achievement Oscar in the form of, you know, Best Score for Star Wars, because it's the last score that he's done. And he's been very clear about this. But in the same sense that we've given Thelma Schoonmaker the editing Oscar for this film, we've given De Niro the Oscar for this film, we've given Scorsese the Oscar for this film, what's different? What's new?
That's always the difficult thing with the Academy Awards in general, is the the melding of, here's someone who's already won a bunch, but gosh darn it if they didn't earn another one. And here's someone who maybe wasn't quite up to the snuff of this person who's like a veteran, but they need to have this on their resume now.
Yeah.
Like that's always kind of the, which way do we go on this kind of thing?
There used to be a sort of, and if you look back at the Academy Awards of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there used to be a pretty easy way to pick Best Supporting Actor and Best Supporting Actress. You would look at Best Supporting Actor and say, which one is the oldest, who doesn't have one? And you look at Best Supporting Actress and say, which one is the youngest? And those were the ones who more often than not would win, because it was a way of welcoming new young female talent into the industry.
Yeah.
And it was a way of saying, hey, you know, Charlton Heston, you made us a lot of money, but you never got an Oscar. So you spent 5 minutes growling as an old man in a supporting role in this family drama that nobody saw, but we're going to give you an Oscar for it. You know, and it was sort of like, you finally get, everybody thinks about Sally Field, you know, finally winning for Norma Rae, you know, on the great, you like me, you really, really like me moment, which is what they were going. Those days are gone. You know, now, really, everywhere up and down the awards, it tends to be stuff that is actually worthy, and stuff that actually deserves to win the awards. So the sentimentality that used to creep into the analysis of the Oscars has kind of been thrown out, and everybody is now like, well, what do the precursors say? And, you know, which way is the wind blowing? There is still one category.
Wild card?
That is formula driven. And that is Best Actor and Best Actress. These are 100% formula driven. And I have, and I'm going to go deeper on this one than any other category. And I'm going to share with you the scale that I use to decide who is going to win this award. And I've been right about these 6 out of the last 6 years. Okay, so I have a 5-point scale that will determine your best actor, best actress. Everything on this scale gets you 1 point, and one of them actually gets you 2. So to win best actor, number one, it's a biopic. And yes, Joker qualifies as a biopic, believe it or not. Number two, disability or major disease. If the role has both, you can get 2 points for this. Addictions, mental illnesses, phobias, depression, all of that count into this category of disability or major disease. That should not be confused with number three, madness. If the character is going mad or goes mad or starts out mad and ends less mad, if you've got a madness scene, you're probably going to get yourself an Oscar.
I definitely agree with.
Number four, homosexual. Doesn't apply to any of the nominees this year. I don't know about the I don't know about the Antonio Banderas thing, but none of the others fall into that category. And number five, overtime. So you were playing this character at several stages in his or her life. This is basically the Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, I'm playing this character from birth to adulthood.
Yeah.
The more points you have on this scale, biopic is number one, disability or major disease is number two, madness, number three, homosexual is number four, overtime is number five. Whoever gets the most points wins. There are two runaway favorites.
For this year, you mean?
For this year, who have won all of the precursor awards because they tick off more boxes than anyone else. And that's Joaquin Phoenix, who is pretty much a mortal lock to win for the Joker.
Yeah.
And Renee Zellweger. As soon as I walked out of the theater after seeing Judy, I said, there's your Oscar.
I was going to say, like...
And that was in October.
That was... And not that she... You know, Renee Zellweger had... I always cite with Chicago, had reached the status of if she goes away for a while, if something, there's no comeback.
Yeah.
It's like she just is. It's like if Meryl Streep decided to not do a movie for 20 years, she comes back. It's not a comeback. She's just Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
But if there were such a thing as like a comeback for Renee Zellweger, I mean, I didn't see Judy, but everyone that saw it was just like, it was downright eerie.
Just
like,
released,
just how well she did.
Just released on Blu-ray. Should be on digital very, very soon.
Oh, good. I was going to say, I did want to see it. It was just at the time that it came out, there were other movies I wanted to see more.
It's a film that...
Like Joker.
Well, no. It's one of these films that starts with credits for 15 different production companies. And the only time that ever happens is when someone is working on a small film... And all of a sudden, a major actor or a major director gets attached to it. So you suddenly have to go out and raise money for it everywhere. And all the people that you go out and raise money from are like, well, I'll give you $100,000 for that. Or I'll give you $1 million for that. It's a $10 million film. You got to go find 10 production companies. Everybody gets their name at the start of it. Because the reason everyone is investing in this is they see... a potential Academy Award winner. The film, the script, is your basic BBC, you know, one part, maybe two part TV movie. Mm. But then you get Renee Zellweger in it, and suddenly it's like, wait a minute, she's agreed to do this. Let's go get a real cast and bump up the production a little bit. So last year it was The Wife, and... I sat there and I watched The Wife and I said, this looks like a Hallmark movie, but it's got really great performances at the center of it. It was Glenn Close and again, Jonathan Pryce. This is the same thing, only much better executed. You know, you sit there and you watch it, and you're like, all right, this feels like it was actually made for the cinema. You know, a lot of work went into this, and there is actually some very excellent staging of all the songs that Renee Zellweger sings as Judy Garland throughout the film. It's great. The supporting roles in it are great. The whole setup of it is great. It is a very entertaining film. Highly recommended. At the very least, you're going to see the best actress performance for the year. And one of the things that really struck me about it is... understanding how films are made, which you do and which I do, because we're both credentialed film people, you know, degrees and stuff. To most actors, when they get that award, tends to be for one, especially a supporting actor, supporting actress, tends to be for one scene. And you look at that one scene and you're like, holy cow, Sally Field in Lincoln has that one scene where she's losing her mind. And Daniel Day-Lewis has to talk her down. And I sat there and I watched that scene and I said, she's getting the Oscar. And it was obvious she was getting the Oscar because that one scene was the scene for her in the movie. For best actor, best actress, you don't get away with that. You have to keep that up for the duration of the film across multiple setups, across multiple shots. One of the things about Judy is when she is on stage and she's singing, It's like that old Sinead O'Connor video. That camera is right in her face.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is her.
There is no place for her to hide as an actress. And it's a moment that Tom Hanks notably fails in Won't You Be My Neighbor. Tom Hanks fails.
When it just is him.
Yeah, Tom Hanks fails in that shot. Renee Zellweger, she almost transcends humanity. Because all you can see is the performance, and all you can see is everything that is coming out of her and off of the screen. It's brilliant.
Well, that, I was going to say, that's like I said, everyone that I know that has seen this movie, all they could say is she's not Renee Zellweger anymore in this movie.
No.
Like, she just is Judy Garland.
Remember cute little sort of frumpy Renee Zellweger, you know, doing the romantic comedies?
You had me at hello.
Yeah. And it's like, not in this film. It's you watch this and you're like immediately like, holy cow.
Yeah.
She fully inhabits that charisma and that personality that we associate with the golden age of Hollywood.
Mm.
You know, with people like Joan Crawford. Judy Garland, obviously, was a hugely charismatic individual. Breakfast at Tiffany's. Why do I always forget her name?
Audrey Hepburn.
And you watch and it's like, well, you never thought of Renee Zellweger as an Audrey Hepburn type, but here she is doing it on the screen. And it's you. I'm sorry, human beings can't just switch that on and off.
Yeah,
you
know, I was going to say, that is the definition of talent. Like, even looking, like, I'm looking online and there's like pictures of like scene side by sides of like, this is what this is based on, and like everything down to like the mannerisms. It's like, you can tell that she studied the crap out of Judy Garland before she made this film.
Yeah.
Because it's like, she doesn't, like, you know, we've known Renee Zellweger since the 90s. Like, we know all her Zellwiggeriness, like, it's, and like the posture, the face, the way that she holds, like, the way, imagine how difficult it is to learn to hold your head differently. You don't think about holding your head because you just do it the same way all the time. To learn to position your head like atop your neck in a different way, that's why I'm always impressed whenever an actor plays an actual person, because it is, I mean, it's, we were talking about this in terms of Tom Hanks,
right?
It's a completely different, because with every character that's a fictional character, you can obviously take and put your own spin on it, make it somehow your own. When you're playing somebody who actually existed, it's like, it's going to be blatant if you're not becoming that person.
And you're playing it, and she's playing Judy at a time in her life that is much written about, but that very few people actually saw.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those shows were selling out in Paris.
I was going to say, a time that was very purposely under the rug.
Yeah. Those shows were selling out in Paris initially. But even if you were there, you aren't as close to her as the camera is in these shots. And to carry that characterization that deep, where you can be there fully inhabiting that person, that to me is where Tom Hanks fails in Won't You Be My Neighbor. Mm. Is because he plays him with a weird squint. I don't understand why he's squinting. I don't remember Mr. Rogers being cockeyed.
I would say, but Tom Hanks squints.
I know. Yeah, but this is pronounced. This is one of the things in acting.
This is like purposeful.
One of the things in acting is we talk about the mask that you put on as the character. You know, where you transform the way that your face normally appears so that you are projecting your impression of who that person is.
Yeah.
So that it's not you on screen, it is the character. There is a great, if you can find it online, there is a great 60 Minutes profile of Bradley Cooper that shows him doing this, because he did The Elephant Man on Broadway a few years ago, around the time that he was doing American Sniper. And he famously did The Elephant Man without any prosthetics and without any sort of costuming. The opening scene of the show is a doctor describing the physical deformities of John Merrick. And you watch Bradley Cooper go from standing straight up, normal Bradley Cooper, to contorting himself into this character.
Yeah.
And the transformation in him is extraordinary. Whoopi Goldberg in Mike Nesmith's Elephant Parts has a bit where she goes from being one character to being another character. And you watch the physical transformation take place in her. It's close in on her face for the whole thing. And you watch the physical transformation take place in her face. It's brilliant. And it cuts to the heart of acting. And that's what Renee Zellweger is doing here. That's why she's nominated. That's why that film is worth seeing.
That's why she's going
to
win.
Yeah. Out on Blu-ray. Shay, you got to see it. You'll love it.
That's what I was going to say. I'm trying to look up when it will be on things I have.
Yeah. Maybe I can coax the Blu-ray away from Molly. It is WMFO Medford. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. This is See It, Skip It, See It, Stream It, Skip It. I'll get that right one of these days, too. And when we come back, we're going to take a look at what's coming up this week and whether it is worth your time. Don't forget, everything you need to know about the Boston music scene. I don't think, knowing this show as well as I do, I think if you're looking for in-depth discussion of the Joey Kramer situation, that's probably not going to happen between 9 and midnight tonight. But you'll learn about what's happening now in the Boston music. Did you hear about the Joey Kramer thing?
I'm looking at it now.
He's suing to get back into the band because they won't let him play.
That's a good way to...
they won't let him play at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. And this is one of those cases where everyone is wrong.
Fun.
This is one of those cases where everyone is wrong. Everyone should feel bad. Good luck with your lawsuit, Mr. Kramer. This is WMFO Medford.
Fever. Paramount Pictures. Everybody's got the fever. Saturday Night Fever. Paramount Pictures presents Saturday Night Fever, starring John Travolta as Tony Manero, the king of the discos. Every guy wants to dance like him. Every girl wants to be with him. Saturday Night Fever. Catch it. Rated R. Under 17. Not admitted without parent.
I'm Sarah, and this is my story.
I'm Ellen, and this is my story. One night, I was at a bar.
I was having fun with my friends. I had one too many drinks. I got behind the wheel to go home.
I got a cab to go home.
All of a sudden, from out of nowhere, a squirrel ran across the road. It happened so quickly, I barely had time to react.
The cabbie barely had time to react. The cab swerved.
I can't believe it. I hit a guy.
I cannot believe it. The cabbie just missed a guy.
I wish I took a cab.
Thank goodness I took a cab.
You have the choice to save a life. Don't drive buzzed. It's a decision you'll never regret. Buzzed driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. We are wrapping things up here at The Big Picture, but before we go, we are going to play See It, Stream It, Skip It, and tell you what we think of the five top movies, or supposed top movies, that are coming out this week.
I think we got four this week. No, I don't know.
I was going to say, did you have any that you deemed not even worth talking about?
Well, it's a weird week. I mean, we're still in the midst.
It is a very weird week.
We're still in the midst of Dumpuary.
Yes, we are.
Hollywood's greatest shame goes to die at the box office. We'll start out with The Gentlemen. This is a new Guy Ritchie movie. Shay, you're a Guy Ritchie fan, aren't you?
I dig on Guy Ritchie well enough.
I know somebody who is over the moon that this one's opening up. You know,
does her name rhyme with golly?
No. Here's the thing with Guy Ritchie. He does drugs and underworld as well as Luc Besson does spy thrillers. You know, so if you're going to see Guy Ritchie, you know what you're going to see walking in. And it's going to be a lot of tough talking drug dealers, and people are going to get shot, and there's going to be violence.
Yeah, like that's, I was going to say, that's what, like, the reviews that I read of The Gentleman, which is the movie that we're talking about, just said, like, it's nothing new from him,
yeah,
but it's what he does well.
Yeah, and it's like, you know what? There's an audience for that.
Oh, yeah.
Hugh Grant is in this for some reason, and Colin Farrell is in this.
It takes place in England. Hugh Grant has to be in it.
Matthew McConaughey is in it, and as near as I can tell, he's playing a Texan. So
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, we can't have McConaughey stretch.
You know, I was gonna say, I mean, all right, McConaughey's playing a Texan.
Yeah, he's playing a Texan. So if you are into the Guy Ritchie experience, go see it. For the rest of us, it's a stream it at best.
I was gonna say, I gave this a stream it. This is not the sort of thing that I would like go and devote theater time.
Yeah,
to.
I'm kind of hit or miss on the Guy Ritchie films. I'd probably rather watch a James Bond movie again than see a Guy Ritchie, but some people are really into it. Second one is The Turning. Mm. And this is interesting. This is the latest in the Nanny in Jeopardy genre of horror.
Nanny in Jeopardy.
DreamWorks is behind this, and they don't produce a lot of stuff anymore. The trailer makes it look like $1 million. The trailer makes it look like we've got Exorcist Omen level production values on this thing. And interestingly, this is only the second feature that this director, Floria Sigismondi, has ever done. Her first film was called Runaways, and it was the biopic of Joan Jett. Or Pat Benatar and The Runaways. Or was that Joan Jett or Pat Benatar? Whichever one was in... It was Joan Jett was in The Runaways.
Yes.
So it was about that band. And now she's back doing a horror movie. We got Mackenzie Davis in it, who you may remember from Terminator Dark Fate. That's not an endorsement. We got Finn Wolfhard in it, who you may remember from Stranger Things. Again, probably not an endorsement. And Julie Richardson, who actually has two movies opening this week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If you're a genre fan, I'm going to say see it.
Yeah.
Because there's enough around the edges of this that tells me it might actually be good. This may be like the sleeper hit of January because you've got a director who's got some style. She's just music videos, mostly. You've got some money being spent from a production company that doesn't really spend a lot of money on projects and a cast that is potentially good.
Yeah, I was going to say, and this is a, this is like based on, what do you call it? The Turn of the Screw, which is like an old novella by, I was going to say it's a Henry James that it's based on.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, it's not without its derivative chops. You know, this isn't like some random, this is something based on like an actually good work of literature.
Classic work of literature that has been made into good films in the past.
Yeah. Like, that's the thing is they say this is a story that gets told, but it gets told a little bit differently every time.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, I'm like, this was a fence on see it or stream it. I'm a big thriller gal. I do enjoy the ooh, it's gonna happen. But I also, like, that's one of those things that I strangely enjoy more, like, in my apartment alone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
so I think it's a stream it at a minimum.
Yeah.
Next up, you're probably seeing it tonight as Color Out of Space. This is an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation, also with Julie Richardson in it, who is joined by Nicolas Cage playing a suburban dad and Tommy Chong. That Tommy Chong.
Yes.
It is
snort a line of Clorox, Tommy Chong.
Directed by the infamous...
Technically, he didn't do that, but that
Richard Stanley. And, you know, they're doing a one-day event screening of this tonight. But if you want to see it, it's going to be at the Kendall for a week. This has potential to be a cult classic. That's what it wants to be.
I was going
to
say, that seems to be basically what it's there for.
If you're into the cult films, it's a see it. For everybody else, I think at a minimum this is a stream it, because there's enough interesting going on here with everyone involved in it that it's like Tommy Chong is in a movie with Nick Cage and it's directed. Yeah.
I was going to say, like, this is a stream it. I had it stream it or skip it. The only reason skip it is because it's not my type of movie.
Right.
And I hate Nicolas Cage.